Production support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
The manager then was like, hey, we're going to have a tea shop. He said, you've always been a good leader. Would you like to take it over? And I was like, sure, I'll try it. Why not? I haven't done that yet.
And that's how an unlikely career in food shot to the next level. We speak with Maria Brummett today. She's a Murray's Cheese Master at Kroger. I'm Annie Corrigan. Welcome to Earth Eats. We make mozzarella, sort of, with Robin Morton. And then from harvest, churches play an important role in bringing the community together in a small Iowa meatpacking town. Mark Chilla is back after a week off. What's up in the news?
Hey, Annie. First up, to Arkansas, where the state plant board voted to ban the sale and use of dicamba. It took that action 2 weeks ago after a wave of complaints about the weed killer drifting into neighboring fields and damaging other crops. So far, there have been 550 complaints in Arkansas, with a total area of damaged soybean fields at nearly 2 million acres. When sprayed on Monsanto's new dicamba-tolerant soybeans, dicamba works great, killing the weeds while leaving the genetically modified soybeans intact. The problem comes when dicamba drifts onto other farm fields of soybeans that are not resistant to dicamba. Farmers in Tennessee, in fact, may have 400,000 acres of damaged soybeans on their hands. As NPR's Dan Charles reported, Monsanto's head of crop protection said in an interview posted on the site CropLife that farmers were still learning how to use dicamba safely. Then on to Kansas. Late last month, a federal jury awarded nearly $218 million to Kansas corn farmers after finding seed giant Syngenta was negligent when it introduced strains of genetically engineered corn seed into the marketplace. Those strains were not approved for import by the Chinese government. Switzerland-based Syngenta issued a statement saying it was disappointed with the verdict because, quote, it will only serve to deny American farmers access to future technologies even when they are fully approved in the U.S., unquote. The case concerns Syngenta's Agrisure Viptera and Agrisure Duracade, corn seeds containing genetically engineered traits. Thousands of farmers sued the company after Chinese officials rejected grain shipments containing traces of the strains in 2013. China is a major importer of U.S. corn. Farmers claim the loss of the Chinese market caused corn prices to plummet, resulting in total losses of more than $5 billion. Other class action cases in state courts are pending in Missouri, Arkansas, Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, Ohio, and South Dakota. The rate of suicides among farmers and farm workers has remained stubbornly high since the end of an economic crisis that rocked the agriculture sector in the late 1980s. That's according to a new study. Researchers at the University of Iowa examined suicide and homicide rates across the country from 1992 to 2010 and found that farmers and farm workers committed suicide at a rate that ranged from nearly twice as high to five times higher than the rate in all other occupations for the same period. The study found a total of 230 U.S. farmers died by suicide during that period. Study co-author Corinne Peek Asa, a professor of occupational and environmental health at the University of Iowa College of Public Health, said lack of access to health care, isolation, extreme weather, and financial stress were key factors in the higher rate. And where are all the Georgia peaches this season? The problem started last winter. Peaches need about 2.5 months of cool nights. George's winter, though, only delivered about 500 hours of 45 degrees and cooler temperatures, which is just about 1 month of cold. Add a two-day March freeze, and peach blossoms from here to North Carolina bit the dust. Georgia lost 85% of its crop. But don't worry, California to the rescue. The Golden State actually produces more peaches than any other state in the country.
Okay, these stories are collected in the new podcast post at eartheats.org. Mark Chilla, who is from Georgia, by the way, thanks for the news.
Go Dogs. See you next week, Annie.
The farmers that grow fruits like apples and peaches depend on bees to pollinate their orchards. But study after study suggests those critically important pollinating insects are at risk. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports on new technology that could help farmers learn more about how their pollinators are doing.
Here are the numbers. 3/4 of global food crops depend on pollinators. In the U.S., pollinators are responsible for more than $24 billion of economic activity, and often that means bees. The problem is that pollinators are disappearing. Beekeepers surveyed last year, for example, lost 1/3 of their colonies. A mix of disease, climate change, and chemicals are often fingered as the culprit.
Native pollinators are the bee's knees.
Dan Kelly owns Blue Heron Orchard in Canton, Missouri, along the Mississippi River. He relies on native bee species.
Native pollinators are absolutely essential in agriculture, especially in fruits and vegetables. You can't do it without them.
Kelly used to borrow honeybee colonies raised by a friend every spring to help pollinate his certified organic apple trees. But 4 years ago, the bees disappeared. He decided then that he couldn't rely on honeybees and shifted his focus to attracting bees native to his Missouri habitat.
The more diversity you have in the operation, the more insects, beneficial insects you have that are working for you, then that's less that I have to do.
Farmers like Kelly would love to know exactly how active bees are in the orchard. That can help him monitor pollination, let him know if he needs to step in and pollinate by hand, and maybe even help him predict how much of a harvest to expect. But native bees are wild, and even if they're buzzing around, are they doing their job?
And the bees are flying in and out through the bottom of the, through a gap at the bottom of the box.
Candy Glenn is a biology professor at the University of Missouri. She studies beneficial partnerships between species. Today, she's on the Columbia, Missouri campus checking on a honeybee hive set up by students outside of an agriculture department building.
I imagine that if we were fast enough to follow them, they would take us to their preferred flowers at this time of the season.
While honeybees often get the spotlight, they are generally managed by beekeepers. Galen wanted to look at native bees, like bumblebees, and see if there was a way to monitor their activity. A tough task for a small team or an individual farmer.
We wanted to figure out, short of cloning ourselves, how we could be in many different places, getting valuable data on bee populations and their abundances and the pollination they're providing for plants at the same time.
When you think bees, you think buzzing. So Galen and her team set up microphones in clover patches, a tasty flower for native bumblebees in central Colorado.
We were very aware of the flight buzzes, and so we thought, if we can hear them, we can record them. And if we can record them, we can count them.
Galen would set up recording devices for a week, take those audio files, like the one right here, feed them through a computer, and voila, it spit out the number of distinct bees. To us, it might sound like a plain old buzz, but Galen and her team were able to break down the buzzes even further. They can identify unique frequencies of individual insects. So the computer told her how many bees were buzzing around, but were they actually doing the pollinating?
That's what a farmer would want to know if they weren't working on alpine clover, but they were working on apples or blueberries. How does my yield relate to this simple measurement of buzz density or activity?
In the fall, she returned to count the seeds in those plants to see how successful the bees were in pollination. Turns out, pretty good. She says the patches of clover where they counted more buzzes during the spring had more seeds in the fall. It's not a conclusive formula, but that's awesome news for, say, a tomato farmer who has opened up her greenhouse to bees for pollination.
And if we have microphones there, we can tell her how she's done and whether that's how much time she needs to leave them open in order to get that great pollination service.
Now, Galen is working on an app to help farmers start counting their own buzzes. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Chris is part of the reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. On our website this week, we have a couple other bee-related stories, one about thieves increasingly targeting beehives in California, and another that digs into complicated results of a new study about how bees are affected by neonicotinoids. Apparently, the local environment plays a big role. Go to eartheats.org to read the articles. Okay, so it's cheese today. Coming up in a bit, we'll meet a person who gives you recommendations on which cheeses will taste great with that bottle of sparkling rosé. A little cooking first, which does seem like a weird verb to use for cheese making, but it's true. Robin Morton spends a lot of time in front of the stove when she teaches people to make fresh cheeses at the White Violet Center for Eco Justice. Paneer and ricotta are pretty easy, good for first-timers. Taking it to the next level...
The mozzarella we're going to make in here, I'm going to struggle with it for a while because I'm really going to be having to force this to work.
Mozzarella. She's got liquid rennet, citric acid, some water, kosher salt, calcium chloride to help the curds form, and a gallon of whole milk. What makes this so tricky, she says, is finding the right ingredients. And as we'll hear, even studying the labels on your milk won't ensure that you're buying what you need to make mozzarella. All right, so here we go. Our first landing point for heating the milk is 55 degrees. That's when she adds the citric acid. Next, it's 88 degrees, and then she adds the rennet. That helps curdle the milk.
Turn it up a little bit.
And then it's the calcium chloride. Then...
My benchmark, what works, what has always worked, is to wait, and you're going to start seeing it. It's going to start to form up, and it's actually going to form into a curd, and it's going to start pulling away from the sides, and you're going to get a gap around the edge of the pan.
We see that. Now it's into a microwave-safe bowl. Nuke it to separate off even more of the whey, then drain the whey.
Okay, as you may have realized, this is not quite mozzarella yet. Now, trying to press it together a little bit.
The curds just weren't cooperating that day. She used a slotted metal spoon to try to mash them together.
Oh, man. This is vaguely working. I'm going to feel really bad if I can't make mozzarella for you guys.
She tried the recipe again from the very beginning, and she still couldn't get the curd to come together. She was baffled by her two failed attempts.
White Violet Center, this is Robin.
Hey, Robin, this is Annie.
Hey.
I called her up several days later to see if she was able to troubleshoot what went wrong. Come to find out, she made mozzarella at home, no problem. She even posted a video of the process online. She made the video for a couple reasons.
One of them was to finally allay my mind that I wasn't going crazy, that this would work. And I wanted to let people know and show them it wasn't the technique. The technique is doable. You just have to get the right product.
Specifically, the right milk.
I got a different brand of milk. I got, you know, just from a different store and a different dairy. And they must have used a more gentle pasteurization technique of some kind. Either they didn't hold it as long or they didn't heat it as high, something like that. And those proteins weren't as badly damaged. And so when I did the exact same process with the new milk, the curd was actually able to hold together so that the whey would come off, and then you could keep getting the whey off and off, and that's how you end up with that curd that you can stretch for a million miles.
But how can you tell when you're buying milk? Because you had the Kroger milk, and it didn't say, this milk is super pasteurized.
You can't. That is one of the incredible frustrations of, in fact, the more I teach this class, the more and more frustrating teaching this class gets.
She says she's just not sure what she's going to get with these store-bought products. Take the buttermilk she used in class to make ricotta. She says a buttermilk label should only include two things, milk and active enzymes. But this bottle she picked up from the store listed 9 or 10 ingredients.
I have no idea what all that other stuff is doing. So that one genuinely mystified me. That's where I knew I was not in Kansas anymore.
So what milks will always work? Farm fresh, unpasteurized milk. But many states have laws forbidding the purchase of raw milk.
She also suggests befriending a dairy company and asking them about their pasteurization techniques. She says low and slow is the best for making cheese. Other than that, trial and error. But when you get it right, mozzarella is so fun to make. The video shows her pulling the cheese a good 3 feet into the air. It really looks like taffy.
What I love about making mozzarella in that class is it's this sort of big payoff at the end of the class. It is the most awesome thing when everybody sees that both, it really is easy, and it is so cool.
Robin Morton is the associate director of the White Violet Center for Eco Justice at St. Mary of the Woods. I posted her mozzarella video on our Twitter feed. Coming up, from fried chicken to cake decorating to a cheese master, Maria Brummett tells us about her unexpected food career. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From gluten-free to kosher and halal, food for everyone, everywhere, full menu, and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. On the east side of Bloomington, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, needmoreroasters.com. Fleeing civil wars, gang violence, and ethnic persecution, migrants and refugees have transformed some small Midwest communities. In big cities and rural areas alike, changing demographics can be stressful. As part of our series United and Divided on Bridging the Urban-Rural Divide, Arvis Public Media's Amy Mayer reports that churches in one Iowa town have different ways of helping all residents navigate change.
As Highway 30 enters Denison, Iowa, a city of 8,000, the national fast food chains stand next to Mexican groceries and restaurants. In this small city near the Nebraska border, waves of immigrants have been arriving since at least the 1980s. Recently, on a hot Sunday, parishioners at the English language mass at St. Rose of Lima exited the church to the sound of a live band and the smell of tacos and pupusas outside. Denison is the seat of Crawford County, where, as of 2015, more than a quarter of the people are Latino. Father Paul Kelly enjoys ministering to both the Spanish and English-speaking parishioners at separate Sunday masses.
You know, the cultures are different in terms of, well, in terms of food interests, and the Hispanic people like to celebrate more outdoors. They're more expressive. Music is a little more lively.
At fundraisers like this one, he says, he often sees a mix of both congregations. Maria Soledad Laura Rodriguez is selling cold bottles of water. She's lived in Denison for 10 years.
I feel safe because it's a very quiet town, and here in the church, helping, we feel good.
15 years ago, Denison had a brief, tragic moment in the national spotlight. 11 people looking for jobs in the large meatpacking plant boarded a train car full of hope, but lacking legal working papers. They were locked in and never let out. A rail worker found their bodies when the car was opened for cleaning. Today, the Latino community is well entrenched. Despite the train car deaths, many still make their way here, out of the poverty or violence of their homes in Mexico or Central America. And they land alongside refugees from Africa and Asia. They're all attracted to the long, hard hours of meatpacking work, which brings a steady paycheck. The churches here play an important role, but it's a tricky one. They want to help the town accept its changing identity, but also offer a place where people feel comfortable. They can be a connection point where different communities come together, but maintaining one's identity rather than shedding it to fit in is also important. Working through that struggle, 21st century immigrants in Denison, Iowa are just like every other newcomer to American shores. Pastor Mark Wallace doesn't want language to segregate his church. He came here in 2009, hired to revive a dying Baptist church.
They told me the community had changed. We had about 50% multi-ethnic, but the church was all white, all seniors, and that wasn't our community.
He committed to creating a multilingual and multi-ethnic congregation. He renamed it Journey Church and started working alongside city officials to help bring different groups together. Wallace says he sees a lot of fear among people who don't know each other.
If we can break down those barriers, then we're better off.
When the South Sudanese Lutheran Community Church gathers, men wear suits and shiny shoes or bright patterned African shirts. Toddlers race about the space that's also used by two other congregations, one largely white, one mostly Latino. Abraham Kamich left South Sudan and studied agriculture at a high school in Kenya. He's lived in Seattle and worked on fishing boats in Alaska. He says he came to check out Denison, thinking he could go back to the Pacific Northwest if he didn't like the work or community.
But when I met the people here in this place, they're amazing people. So I feel happy and happiest.
He works at the meatpacking plant too, and he likes being able to worship in his native language, Dinka. The desire for comfort and familiarity is going to split many people along linguistic or cultural lines, even in churches committed to embracing the changing communities they serve. And that's pretty much the same story, whether the community is a small town or a big city. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Listen to more stories from Harvest's United and Divided series at harvestpublicmedia.org. In December 2016, Kroger and Murray's Cheese opened their 350th store location and just happened to be in Bloomington, Indiana. That's sort of a fun fact that kicks off our conversation today with Maria Brummett. She's a Murray's Cheese Master in Bloomington. A job that was initially intended just for pocket change has now given Maria the opportunity to be an expert in her field. First things first, if you want to go behind the cheese counter at Kroger, you have to wear the right equipment. All right, hairnet. Okay, headphones over top. Kroger ready. This Murray's cheese counter features something like 175 different varieties of cheese. There are little info cards that give you every bit of information you could ever care to know about every block of cheese. That same info is collected in a hefty binder in the break room. This is Maria's Cheese Bible. She's using it to study for the American Cheese Society's test to become a certified cheese professional.
I've already didn't pass once, but I'm going to try it again.
She travels to Denver at the end of July to take the test.
You have to know the milk type. We have to know where they're from, and which ones are name-protected cheeses, which ones are not, how to make a plate of cheese with different ones, how to actually make cheese.
You have to know how to make cheese?
Yeah, we have to know all the steps and the temperatures that each different cheese has, the temperatures of the caves that they're in, and what they have to do to them, and gotta know which beer and wine goes with the cheese as well. It's a lot.
So name-protected cheeses, for instance?
Like the Parmigiano Reggiano can only be made in a certain area in Italy, the milk can only travel so far, or it can't be called Parmigiano Reggiano. And they also save the leftover whey. They feed it to their pigs, and that's how they make prosciutto di Parma. And that also has to be made in a certain area, and that's why it's so rich and buttery.
She also has to know the fat content of the different milks.
Like the goat milk is a lot lower in fat, and then the sheep milk is higher. So it goes goat, cow, sheep, and then buffalo.
Buffalo is the highest in fat.
Yes, and they only make, they usually just make mozzarella with it. You cannot drink buffalo milk because it's like yogurt.
That sort of memorization is easy and fun for her.
I think my hardest part is probably the math, like the margin and markup and converting grams to ounces and pounds. And so that's kind of tough for me because I only did like the basic math in school. My son, he was like, graduated from IU with honors, and he did like the highest math you could do, and I'm like, maybe I need to have him help me.
These days, her brain is flooded with facts about fancy cheeses, but she grew up eating the processed stuff.
We had government cheese, which is now I know is fake cheese, like Kraft and all that. American cheese is only, they have to use 50% real cheese, and then I don't know what else they put in it. But back then, it was really good. But we used to make some big, thick grilled cheese sandwiches.
She was raised by a single mother. They lived in California, Florida, and New York. But she's called Indiana home most of her life.
I was 18, 20, and 22 when I had my kids. I dropped out of my senior year of high school. I was pregnant, but I went back the following year. I was married, had a baby, lived in my own house, and graduated high school. So, and I got the Comeback Kid of the Year award because I was out on my own and I went to school every day and I got good grades. So,
she was 25 when she decided to pick up a job at Kroger to make some extra money. First, they had her frying chicken.
They called me the chicken lady. I was a cake decorator. I learned how to bake bread. And then I led the deli, I led the bakery, and then I led all of it.
And then it was over to the cheese.
I was helping in the bakery, doing their fancy cakes and all that. And the manager then was like, hey, we're going to have a cheese shop. He said, you've always been a good leader. Would you like to take it over? And I was like, sure, I'll try it. Why not? I haven't done that yet.
That was 9 years ago. She's 46 years old now. She travels around the state helping other stores open cheese counters, and she'd love to do that full-time.
I didn't think I was going to have a career. Just thought, oh, I'll just go work for a little bit and then move on to something else. But I think out of all the jobs I've done in Kroger, this is my favorite. Well, I've been eating cheese all my life, but just the learning part of it is, it's pretty cool.
I should leave here with one cheese, what would it be?
I would say the St. Angel Brie. It's a triple cream brie. It's 72% butterfat, so anything over 75 is butter. If you let it, and you always want to sit your cheese out and let it get to room temperature, because that has the most flavor then.
So it's almost amazing. Butter.
Yes, almost butter. It is amazing.
Maria Brummett is a Murray's Cheese Master in Bloomington, Indiana. She did admit to me that she still has some processed pseudo-cheese products in her house for her husband, but she doesn't dare eat the stuff herself. See a picture of Maria at eartheats.org. Special thanks today to Jackie Howard of the College Mall Kroger and the folks at the White Violet Center. Our Every Week heroes are Aobon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, and Harvest Public Media. Earth Eats executive producer is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters, your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. I'm Annie Corrigan. Over and out.